This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Gathering Blue by Lois Lowry.
This is Lois Lowry. I suppose as we hurtle through space, blasting now into another century, all of us think about the what comes next part. When I ponder questions that fall into the what-if category, people appear on my blank slate imagination. Fictional people. This time, for me, it was a girl. I gave her a name. That's always what I do first. And once she was named, Kira became real to me, human, and valuable. And gradually her world became real, too, mysterious as it was. It makes sense to me that at some time in the distant future, after the world we know has wrecked itself, as it well may, new kinds of societies will emerge. Highly technical, tightly structured, rigidly controlled, maybe. I created such a world when I wrote The Giver. But it seems possible to me that other kinds of worlds might evolve. How about a society with no technology at all? How about a community of disorder, savagery, and self-interest? That's where I found Kira. She was sitting on animal skins, frightened and alone, beside a dead body. Gradually, I began to perceive that this girl and the people who entered her environment as I wrote were actually a pretty complex society, even though their day-to-day existence was quite primitive. They washed in a stream, hunted animals for food, and left their dead to rot in a field. Yet they had thick volumes of law, some odd vestiges from a past civilization, and even hints of a lost religion. We who write tend to fall in love with our characters. We create impossible journeys with extraordinary destinations for them to take, and we place hideous obstacles in their way. But because we love them, and I'm talking passion here, not just a casual affection, we want them to get through safely, unscathed, and triumphant. I wanted this imperfect, innocent, and gifted girl not only to make it to the end, but also to make a difference. Creative artists, I believe, have that capacity. And so I made Kira an artist, with the kind of vision and power that artists have. At the conclusion of the book, she holds in her hands the fragile beginnings of a peaceful future. I like endings that contain such hope. This is Lois Lowry in August 2000.
Chapter 1. Mother? There was no reply. She hadn't expected one. Her mother had been dead now for 4 days, and Kira could tell that the last of the spirit was drifting away. Mother, she said it again, quietly, to whatever was leaving. She thought that she could feel its leave-taking, the way one could feel a small whisper of breeze at night. Now she was all alone. Kira felt the aloneness, the uncertainty, and a great sadness. This had been her mother, the warm and vital woman whose name had been Katrina. Then, after the brief and unexpected sickness, it had become the body of Katrina, still containing the lingering spirit. After 4 sunsets and sunrises, the spirit, too, was gone. It was simply a body. Diggers would come and sprinkle a layer of soil over the flesh, but even so it would be eaten by the clawing, hungry creatures that came at night. Then the bones would scatter, rot, and crumble to become part of the earth. Kira wiped briefly at her eyes, which had filled suddenly with tears. She had loved her mother and would miss her terribly, but it was time for her to go. She wedged her walking stick in the soft ground, leaned on it, and pulled herself up. She looked around uncertainly. She was young still, and had not experienced death before, not in the small 2-person family that she and her mother had been. Of course she had seen others go through the rituals. She could see some of them in the vast, foul-smelling field of leaving, huddled beside the ones whose lingering spirits they tended. She knew that a woman named Helena was there, watching the spirit leave her infant, who had been born too soon. Helena had come to the field only the day before. Infants did not require the 4 days of watching. The wisps of their spirits, barely arrived, drifted away quickly. So Helena would return to the village and her family soon. As for Kira, she had no family now, nor any home. The cot she had shared with her mother had been burned. This was always done after sickness. The small structure, the only home Kira had ever known, was gone. She had seen the smoke in the distance as she sat with the body. As she watched the spirit of her mother drift away, she had seen the cindered fragments of her childhood life whirl into the sky as well. She felt a small shudder of fear. Fear was always a part of life for the people. Because of fear, they made shelter and found food and grew things. For the same reason, weapons were stored, waiting. There was fear of cold, of sickness and hunger. There was fear of beasts. And fear propelled her now as she stood leaning on her stick. She looked down a last time at the lifeless body that had once contained her mother and considered where to go. Kira thought about rebuilding. If she could find help, though help was unlikely, it wouldn't take long to build a cot, especially not this time of year, summer start, when tree limbs were supple and mud was thick and abundant beside the river. She had often watched others building, and Kira realized that she could probably construct some sort of shelter for herself. Its corners and chimney might not be straight. The roof would be difficult because her bad leg made it almost impossible for her to climb. But she would find a way. Somehow she would build a cot. Then she would find a way to make a life. Her mother's brother had been near her in the field for 2 days, not guarding Katrina, his sister, but sitting silently beside the body of his own woman, the short-tempered Solora, and that of their new infant, who had been too young to have a name. They had nodded to each other, Kira and her mother's brother, in acknowledgement. But he had departed, his time in the field of leaving finished. He had tykes to tend. He and Solora had 2 others in addition to the one that had brought about her death. The others were still small, their names yet of 1 syllable, Dan and Mar. "Perhaps I could care for them," Kira thought briefly, trying to find her own future within the village. But even as the thought flickered within her, she knew that it would not be permitted. Solora's tykes would be given away, distributed to those who had none. Healthy, strong tykes were valuable. Properly trained, they could contribute to family needs and would be greatly desired. No one would desire Kira. No one ever had, except her mother. Often Katrina had told Kira the story of her birth, the birth of a fatherless girl with a twisted leg, and how her mother had fought to keep her alive. "They came to take you," Katrina said, whispering the story to her in the evening, in their cot, with the fire fed and glowing. "You were 1 day old, not yet named your 1-syllable infant name." "Kir." "Yes, that's right, Kir. They brought me food and were going to take you away to the field." Kira shuddered. It was the way, the custom, and it was the merciful thing, to give an unnamed, imperfect infant back to the earth before its spirit had filled it and made it human. But it made her shudder. Katrina stroked her daughter's hair. "They meant no harm," she reminded her. Kira nodded. "They didn't know it was me." "It wasn't you, yet." "Tell me again why you told them no," Kira whispered. Her mother sighed, remembering. "I knew I would not have another child," she pointed out. "Your father had been taken by beasts. It had been several months since he went off to hunt and did not return, and so I would not give birth again. Oh," she added, "perhaps they would have given me one eventually, an orphan to raise. But as I held you, even then, with your spirit not yet arrived and with your leg bent wrong so that it was clear you would not ever run, even then, your eyes were bright. I could see the beginning of something remarkable in your eyes. And your fingers were long and well-shaped. And strong. My hands were strong," Kira added with satisfaction. She had heard the story so often. Each time of hearing, she looked down at her strong hands with pride. Her mother laughed. So strong, they gripped my own thumb fiercely and would not let go. Feeling that fierce tug on my thumb, I could not let them take you away. I simply told them no. They were angry. Yes, but I was firm. And of course my father was still alive. He was old then, 4 syllables, and he had been the leader of the people, the chief guardian, for a long time. They respected him. And your father would have been a greatly respected leader, too, had he not died on the long hunt. He had already been chosen to be a guardian. Say my father's name to me, Kira begged. Her mother smiled in the firelight. Christopher, she said. You know that. I like to hear it, though. I like to hear you say it. Do you want me to go on? Kira nodded. You were firm. You insisted, she reminded her mother. Still, they made me promise that you would not become a burden. I haven't, have I? Of course not. Your strong hands and wise head make up for the crippled leg. You are a sturdy and reliable helper in the weaving shed. All the women who work there say so. And one bent leg is of no importance when measured against your cleverness. The stories you tell to the tykes, the pictures you create with words and with thread, the threading you do, it is unlike any threading the people have ever seen, far beyond anything I could do. Her mother stopped. She laughed. Enough. You mustn't tease me into flattery. Don't forget that you are still a girl, and often willful, and just this morning, Kira, you forgot to tidy the cot even though you had promised.
I won't forget tomorrow,
Kira said sleepily, snuggling against her mother on the raised sleeping mat. She pushed her twisted leg into a more comfortable position for the night.
I promise.
But now there was no one to help her. She had no family left, and she was not a particularly useful person in the village. For everyday work, Kira helped in the weaving shed, picking up the scraps and leavings, but her twisted leg diminished her value as a laborer, and even, in the future, as a mate. Yes, the women liked the fanciful stories that she told to amuse restless tykes, and they admired the little threadings that she made. But those things were diversions. They were not work. The sky, with the sun no longer overhead, but sending shadows now into the field of leaving, from the trees and thorn bushes at its edge, told her that it was long past midday. In her uncertainty, she had lingered here too long. Carefully, she gathered the skins on which she had slept these 4 nights, guarding her mother's spirit. Her fire was cold ashes, a blackened smudge. Her water container was empty, and she had no more food. Slowly, using her stick, she limped toward the path that led back to the village, holding on to a small hope that she might still be welcome there. Tykes played at the edge of the clearing, scampering about on the moss-covered ground. Pine needles stuck to their naked bodies and in their hair. She smiled. She recognized each little one. There was the yellow-haired son of her mother's friend. She remembered his birth 2 midsummers ago. And the girl whose twin had died. She was younger than the yellow-haired one, just toddling, but she giggled and shrieked with the others, playing catch me while I'm running. Tussling, the toddlers slapped and kicked at each other, grabbing toy sticks, flailing with their small fists. Kira remembered watching her childhood companions at such play, preparing for the real scramble of adult life. Unable to participate because of her flawed leg, she had watched from the sidelines with envy. An older child, a dirty-faced boy of 8 or 9 years, still too young for puberty and the 2-syllable name that he would receive, looked over at her from the place where he was clearing underbrush and sorting the twigs into bundles for fire starting. Kira smiled. It was Matt, who had always been her friend. She liked Matt. He lived in the swampy, disagreeable fen, probably the child of a dragger or digger. But he ran freely through the village with his disorderly friends, his dog always at his heels. Often he stopped, as now, to do some chore or small job in return for a few coins or a sweet. Kira called a greeting to the boy. The dog's bent tail, matted with twigs and leaves, thumped on the ground, and the boy grinned in reply.
"So you be back from the field," he said. "What's it like there? Scared, was you? Did creatures come in the night?"
Kira shook her head and smiled at him. Younger one-syllable tykes were not allowed in the field, so it was natural that Matt would be curious and a little in awe.
"No creatures," she reassured him. "I had fire, and it kept them away." "So Katrina be gone now from her body?" he asked, in his dialect.
People from the fen were oddly different, always identifiable by their strange speech and crude manners. They were looked down upon by most people, but not by Kira. She was very fond of Matt. She nodded.
"My mother's spirit has gone," she acknowledged. "I watched it leave her body. It was like mist. It drifted away."
Matt came over to her, still carrying an armful of twigs. He squinted at her ruefully and wrinkled his nose.
"Your cot is horrid burnt," he told her.
Kira nodded. She knew that her home had been destroyed, though secretly she had hoped she was mistaken.
"Yes," she sighed. "And everything in it? My frame? Did they burn my threading frame?"
Matt frowned. "I tried to save things, but it's mostly all burnt. Just your cot, Kira. Not like when there's a big sickness. This time it just be your mum."
"I know."
Kira sighed again. In the past, there had been sicknesses that spread from one cot to the next, with many deaths. When that happened, a huge burning would take place, followed by a rebuilding that became almost festive, with the noise of workers smearing wet mud over the fitted wooden sides of new structures, methodically slapping it into smoothness. The charred smell of the burning would remain in the air even as the new cots rose. But today there was no festivity. There were only the usual sounds. Katrina's death had changed nothing in the lives of the people. She had been there, now she was gone. Their lives continued. With the boy still beside her, Kira paused at the well and filled her container with water. Everywhere she heard arguing. The cadence of bickering was a constant sound in the village, the harsh remarks of men vying for power, the shrill bragging and taunting of women envious of one another and irritable with the tykes, who whined and whimpered at their feet and were frequently kicked out of the way. She cupped her hand over her eyes and squinted against the afternoon sun to find the gap where her own cot had been. She took a deep breath. It would be a long walk to gather saplings, and a hard chore to dig the mud by the riverbank. The corner timbers would be heavy to lift and hard to drag.
"I have to start building," she told Matt, who still held a bundle of twigs in his scratched, dirty arms. "Do you want to help? It could be fun if there were two of us. I can't pay you, but I'll tell you some new stories," she added.
The boy shook his head.
"I be whipped if I don't finish the fire twiggies."
He turned away. After a hesitation, he turned back to Kira and said in a low voice,
"I heard them talking. They don't want you should stay. They be planning to turn you out, now your mum be dead. They be set on putting you in the field for the beasts. They talk about having draggers take you."
Kira felt her stomach tighten with fear, but she tried to keep her voice calm. She needed information from Matt, and it would make him wary to know she was frightened.
"Who's they?"
she asked in an annoyed, superior tone.
"Them women," he replied. "I heard them talking at the well. I'd be picking up wood chippies from the refuse, and them didn't even notice me listening. But they want your space. They want where your cot was. They aim to build a pen there to keep the tykes and the fowls enclosed so they don't be having to chase them all the time."
Kira stared at him. It was terrifying, almost unbelievable, the casualness of the cruelty. In order to pen their disobedient toddlers and chickens, the women would turn her out of the village to be devoured by the beasts that waited in the woods to forage the field.
"Whose was the strongest voice against me?" she asked after a moment.
Matt thought. He shifted the twigs in his hands, and Kira could see that he was reluctant to get involved in her problems and fearful of his own fate. But he had always been her friend. Finally, looking around first to be certain he wouldn't be overheard, he told her the name of the person with whom Kira would have to do battle.
"Thandara," he whispered.
It came as no surprise. Nonetheless, Kira's heart sank. Chapter 2 First, Kira decided, it made sense to pretend she knew nothing. She would go back to the site of the cot where she had lived with her mother and begin to rebuild. Perhaps the simple fact of seeing her there at work would deter the women who hoped to drive her away. Leaning on her stick, she made her way through the crowded village. Here and there, people acknowledged her presence with a curt nod, but they were busy, all of them at their daily work, and pleasantries were not part of their custom. She saw her mother's brother. With his son, Dan, he was working in the garden beside the cot where he had lived with Solora and the Tykes. Weeds had gone untended while his wife had neared her time, given birth, and died. Then more days had passed, more weeds had flourished, while he sat in the field with his dead wife and infant. The poles that held beans entwined had toppled, and he was angrily setting them upright as Dan tried to help, and the younger Tyke, the girl named Mar, sat playing in the dirt at the edge. While Kira looked on, the man slapped his son hard on the shoulder, scolding him for not holding the pole straight. She walked past them, planting her stick firmly in the ground with each step, planning to nod if they acknowledged her. But the small girl playing in the dirt only whimpered and spat. She had tried tasting some pebbles in the way of toddlers, and had found herself with a mouthful of foul-tasting grit. The boy, Dan, glanced at Kira, but made no sign of greeting or recognition. He was cringing from his father's slap. The man, her mother's only brother, didn't look up from his labor. Kira sighed. At least he had help. Unless she could enlist her small friend Matt and some of his mates, she would have to do all of her work, rebuilding, gardening, herself, assuming she was allowed to stay. Her stomach growled, and she realized how hungry she was. Rounding the path past a row of small cots, she approached her own location and came upon the black heap of ashes that had been her home. There was nothing left of their household things. But she was pleased to see that the little garden remained. Her mother's flowers still bloomed, and the summer start vegetables were ripening in the sun. For now, at least, she would have some food. Or would she? As she watched, a woman darted out of a clump of nearby trees, glanced at Kira, and then brazenly began to pull carrots from the garden that Kira and her mother had tended together.
"Stop it! Those are mine!"
Kira moved forward as quickly as she could, dragging her deformed leg. Laughing contemptuously, the woman sauntered away, her hands filled with dirt-encrusted carrots. Kira hurried to the remains of the garden. She set her water container on the ground, pulled up some tubers, brushed the dirt away, and began to eat. Without a hunter as part of their family, she and her mother had not eaten meat, except for the occasional small creature that they could catch within the boundaries of the village. They could not go to the woods to hunt the way men did. Fish from the river were plentiful and easy to catch, and they felt no need of anything more. But the vegetables were essential. She was fortunate, she realized, that the garden had not been entirely stripped during her 4 days in the field. Her hunger satisfied, she sat down to rest her leg. She looked around. On the edge of her space, near the ashes, a pile of saplings, stripped of their branches, was arranged as if someone had been preparing to help her rebuild. But Kira knew better. She rose and tentatively picked up one of the slender, pliable saplings from the pile. Thandara emerged immediately from the nearby clearing where Kira realized she had been waiting and watching. Kira didn't know where the woman lived or who her hubby or children might be. Her cot was none of those nearby, but she was very much known in the village. People whispered about her. She was known and respected, or feared. The woman was tall and muscular, with long, tangled hair pulled back roughly and tied with a thong at the back of her neck. Her eyes were dark, and her direct look pierced any calmness that Kira might have felt. The ragged scar that marked her chin and continued down her neck to her broad shoulder was said to be a remnant of a long-ago battle with one of the forest creatures. No one else had ever survived such a clawing, and the scar reminded everyone of Vandara's courage and vigor, as well as her malevolence. She had been attacked and clawed, the children whispered, when she tried to steal an infant creature from its mother's den. Today, facing Kira, she was once again preparing to destroy someone's young. Unlike the forest creature, Kira had no claws with which to fight. She gripped her wooden cane tightly and tried to stare back with no hint of fear. "I've returned to rebuild my cot," she told Vandara. "Your space is gone. It's mine now. Those saplings are mine." "I will cut my own," Kira conceded. "But I will rebuild on this space. This was my father's space before I was born, and my mother's after he died. Now that she's dead, it's mine." Other women emerged from surrounding cots. "We need it," one called. "We're going to use the saplings to build a pen for the tykes. It was Vandara's idea." Kira looked at the woman who was holding the arm of a toddler roughly. "It might be a good idea," Kira replied, "if you want to pen your little ones, but not on this piece of ground. You can build a pen somewhere else." She saw Vandara lean down and pick up a rock the size of a tyke's fist. "We don't want you here," the woman said. "You don't belong in the village anymore. You're worthless with that leg. Your mother always protected you, but she's gone now. You should go too. Why didn't you just stay in the field?" Kira saw that she was surrounded by hostile women who had come from their cots and were watching Vandara for instructions and leadership. Several, she noticed, had rocks in their hands. If one rock were thrown, others would follow, she knew. They were all waiting for the first. "What would my mother have done?" she thought frantically, and tried to call wisdom from the bit of her mother's spirit that lived on in her now. "Or my father, who never knew of my birth. His spirit is in me, too." Kira straightened her shoulders and spoke. She held her voice steady and tried to meet the eyes of each woman in turn. Some lowered their gaze and looked at the ground. That was good. It meant they were weak. "You know that in a village conflict that could bring death, we must go to the Council of Guardians," Kira reminded them. She heard some murmurs of assent. Vandara's hand still gripped the rock, and her shoulders were tense, preparing to throw. Kira looked directly at Vandara, but she was speaking to the others now, in need of their support. She appealed not to their sympathy, because she knew they had none, but to their fear. "Remember that if conflict is not taken to the Council of Guardians, and if there is a death..." She heard a murmur. "If there is a death..." She heard a woman repeat in an uncertain, apprehensive voice. Kira waited. She stood as tall and straight as she could. Finally, a woman in the group completed words of the rule. "The causer of death must die." "Yes. The causer of death must die." Other voices repeated it. One by one, they released the rocks. One by one, each woman chose not to be a causer of death. Kira began to relax slightly. She waited. She watched. Finally, only Vandara still held her weapon. Glaring, Vandara menaced her, bending her elbow as if to throw. But at last, she, too, dropped the rock on the ground, with a slight harmless toss toward Kira. "I will take her to the Council of Guardians, then," Vandara announced to the women. "I am willing to be her accuser. Let them cast her out." She laughed harshly. "No need for us to waste a life getting rid of her. By sunset tomorrow, this ground can be ours, and she will be gone.
She will be in the field, waiting for the beasts.
The women all glanced toward the forest, deep in shadows now, the place where the beasts waited. Kira forced herself not to follow their looks with her own eyes. With the same hand that had held the rock, Vandara stroked the scar on her throat. She smiled cruelly.
"I remember what it was like," she said, "to see your own blood pour upon the ground."
"I survived," she reminded them all. "I survived because of my strength. By night start tomorrow, when she feels the claws at her throat," she went on, "this two-syllable mistake of a girl will wish she had died of sickness beside her mother."
Nodding in agreement, the women turned their backs on Kira and moved away, scolding and kicking at the small tykes by their sides. The sun was low in the sky now. They would attend to their evening tasks, preparing for the return of the village men, who would need food and fire and the wrapping of wounds. One woman was soon to give birth. Perhaps that would happen tonight, and the others would attend her, muffling her cries and assessing the value of the infant. Others would be coupling tonight, creating new people, new hunters for the future of the village, as the old ones died of wounds and illness and age. Kira did not know what the Council of Guardians would decide. She knew only that whether she was to stay or go, to rebuild on her mother's piece of land, or to enter the field and face the creatures who were waiting in the forest, she would have to do it alone. Wearily, she sat on the ash-blackened earth to wait for night. She reached for a nearby piece of wood and turned it over in her hands, measuring its strength and its straightness. For a cot, should she be permitted to stay, she would need some sturdy lengths of solid wood. She would go to the woodcutter named Martin. He had been her mother's friend. She could barter with him, maybe offering to decorate a fabric for his wife in exchange for the beams she would need. For her future, for the work with which she thought she might earn her living, she would also need some small, straight pieces of wood. This one was too pliable and would not do, she realized, and dropped it on the ground. Tomorrow, if the Council of Guardians decided in her favor, she would look for the kind of wood she needed. Short, smooth pieces she could fit together at the corners. She was already planning to build a new threading frame. Kira had always had a clever way with her hands. When she was still a tyke, her mother had taught her to use a needle, to pull it through woven fabric and create a pattern with colored threads. But suddenly, recently, the skill had become more than simple cleverness. In one astounding burst of creativity, her ability had gone far beyond her mother's teaching. Now, without instruction or practice, without hesitancy, her fingers felt the way to twist and weave and stitch the special threads together, to create designs rich and explosive with color. She did not understand how the knowledge had come to her, but it was there, in her fingertips, and now they trembled slightly with eagerness to start. If only she was allowed to stay. Chapter 3. A messenger, bored and scratching at an insect bite on his neck, came to Kira in the dawn and told her that she must report to the Council of Guardians at late morning. When the sun was approaching midday, she tidied herself and went, obedient to his instruction. The council edifice was surprisingly splendid. It remained from before the ruin, a time so far past that none of the people now living, none of their parents or grandparents, had been born. The people knew of the ruin only from the song that was presented at the yearly gathering. Rumor said that the singer, whose only job in the village was the annual presentation of the song, prepared his voice by resting for days and sipping certain oils. The ruin song was lengthy and exhausting. It began with the beginning of time, telling the entire story of the people over countless centuries. It was frightening, too. The story of the past was filled with warfare and disasters.
Most especially it was frightening when it recalled the ruin, the end of the civilization of the ancestors. Verses told of smoky, poisonous fumes, of great fractures in the earth itself, of the way huge buildings toppled and were swept away by the seas. All of the people were required to listen each year, but sometimes mothers protectively covered the ears of their smallest tykes during the description of the ruin. Very little had survived the ruin, but somehow the structure called the Council Edifice had remained standing and firm. It was immeasurably old. Several windows still contained patterned glass of deep reds and golds. Amazing things, for knowledge of the way of making such remarkable glass had been lost. Some remaining windows, ones in which the colored glass had shattered, were now paned in a thick, ordinary glass that distorted the view through bubbles and ripples. Other windows were simply boarded over, and parts of the building's interior were darkly shadowed. Still, the edifice was magnificent in comparison to the ordinary sheds and cottages of the village. Kira, reporting near midday, as she had been ordered by the messenger, walked alone down a long hallway, lit on either side by sputtering flames from tall sconces fed with oil. She could hear the voices of the meeting ahead, behind a closed door, men's voices in muted arguing. Her stick thumped on the wooden floor, and the foot of her flawed leg brushed the boards with a sweeping sound as if she dragged a broom. "Take pride in your pain," her mother had always told her. "You are stronger than those who have none." She remembered that now, and tried to find the pride that her mother had taught her to feel. She straightened her thin shoulders and smoothed the folds of her coarsely woven shift. She had washed carefully in the clear stream water and had cleaned her nails with a sharp twig. She had combed her hair with the carved wooden comb that had been her mother's, and which she had added to her own small storage sack after her mother's death. Then she had braided her hair, using her hands to interweave the thick dark strands deftly, tying the end of the heavy plait with a leather strip. Steadying her apprehensions with a deep breath, Kira knocked on the heavy door to the room where the Council of Guardians meeting was already in progress. It opened a crack, spilling a wedge of light into the dim hall. A man looked out and eyed her suspiciously. He widened the opening and gestured her inside.
"The accused orphan girl, Kira, is here," the door guard announced, and the muttering subsided.
In silence, they all turned to watch her enter. The chamber was huge. Kira had been there before with her mother on ceremonial occasions like the annual gathering. Then they had sat with the crowds on rows of benches facing the stage that was furnished only with an altar table holding the worship object, the mysterious wooden construction of two sticks connected to form a cross. It was said to have had great power in the past, and the people always bowed briefly and humbly toward it in respect. But now she was alone. There were no crowds, no ordinary citizens, only the Council of Guardians, 12 men who sat facing her across a long table at the foot of the stage. Rows of oil lamps made the room bright, and each of the men had his personal torch behind him, illuminating stacked and scattered papers that lay on the table. They watched her as she made her way hesitantly up the aisle. Quickly, remembering the procedure that she had seen at every ceremony, Kira arranged her hands in a reverent position, cupped together, fingertips below her chin, as she arrived at the table and looked respectfully toward the worship object on the stage. The guardians nodded approvingly. Apparently it had been the right gesture. She relaxed a bit, waiting, wondering what would happen next. The door guard responded to a second knock and announced a second entry.
"The accuser, Vandara," he called.
So, it was to be the two of them. Kira watched as Vandara strode rapidly toward the table until they were side by side facing the Council of Guardians. It gave her a small feeling of satisfaction to notice that Dandara's feet were bare and her face dirty. The woman had made no special preparations. Perhaps none was necessary. But Kira felt that possibly she had gained a small bit of respect, a small advantage with her cleanliness. Dandara made the worshipful gesture with her hands, so they were even there. Then Dandara bowed, and Kira saw with a twinge of concern that the guardians nodded their heads toward her.
I should have bowed. I must find an occasion to bow.
We meet to pass judgment on a conflict.
The chief guardian, a white-haired man with a four-syllable name that Kira could never remember, spoke in an authoritative voice.
I had no conflict. I only wanted to rebuild my cot and live my life.
Who is the accuser?
The white-haired man asked.
Of course he knew the answer, Kira thought. But the question seemed to be ceremonial, part of the formal proceedings.
It was answered by another of the guardians, a heavy-set man at the end of the table who had several thick books and a stack of papers in front of him. Kira eyed the volumes curiously. She had always yearned to read, but women were not allowed.
Chief Guardian, the accuser is the woman Vandara. And the accused? The accused is the orphan girl Kira.
The man glanced at the papers, but didn't seem to be reading anything.
Accused? What am I accused of?
Hearing the repetition of the word, Kira felt a wave of panic.
But I can use it as a chance to bow and show humility.
She inclined her head and upper body slightly, acknowledging herself as the accused. The white-haired man looked at the two of them dispassionately. Kira, leaning on her stick, tried to stand as straight as possible. She was almost as tall as her accuser, but Vandara was older, heavier, and unflawed except for the scar, the reminder that she had fought a beast and escaped alive. Hideous though it was, the scar emphasized her strength. Kira's flaw carried no illustrious history, and she felt weak, inadequate, and doomed beside the disfigured, angry woman.
The accuser will speak first, the chief guardian instructed.
Vandara's voice was firm and bitter.
The girl should have been taken to the field when she was born and still nameless. It is the way. Go on, the chief guardian said. She was imperfect and fatherless as well. She should not have been kept.
But I was strong, and my eyes were bright. My mother told me. She wouldn't let me go.
Kira shifted her weight, resting her twisted leg, remembering the story of her birth, and wondering if she would have an opportunity to tell it here.
I gripped her thumb so tightly.
We have all tolerated her presence for these years, Vandara went on, but she has not contributed. She cannot dig, or plant, or weed, or even tend the domestic beasts the way other girls her age do. She drags that dead leg around like a useless burden. She is slow, and she eats a lot.
The Council of Guardians was listening carefully. Kira's face felt warm with embarrassment. It was true that she ate a lot. It was all true, what her accuser was saying.
I can try to eat less. I can go hungry.
In her mind, Kira prepared her defense, but even as she did, she felt that it would be weak and whining.
She was kept against the rules because her grandfather was still alive and had power. But he is long gone, replaced by a new leader with more power and wisdom.
Vandara oozed compliments designed to strengthen her case, and Kira glanced at the chief guardian to see if he was swayed by the flattery. But his face was impassive.
Her father was killed by beasts, even before her birth, and now her mother is dead.
Vandara went on.
There's even reason to think that her mother may have carried an illness that will endanger others.
No, she was the only one to fall ill. Look at me. I lay beside her when she died, and I'm not ill.
And the women need the space where their cot was. There is no room for this useless girl. She can't marry. No one wants a cripple. She takes up space and food, and she causes problems with the discipline of the tykes, telling them stories, teaching them games so that they make noise and disrupt the work. The chief guardian waved his hand. Enough, he announced. Dandara frowned and fell silent. She bowed slightly. The chief guardian looked around the table at the 11 others as if he sought comments or questions. One by one they nodded at him. No one said anything. Kira, the white-haired chief guardian said, as a two-syllable girl, you are not required to defend yourself.
Not defend myself, but... Kira had planned to bow again, but forgot in her urgency. Now she remembered, but her bow was an awkward afterthought. He waved his hand again, signaling her silence. She forced herself to be still and to listen.
Because of your youth, he explained, you have a choice. You may defend yourself.
She interrupted again, unable to stop. Oh, yes, I want to def...
He ignored her outburst. Or we will appoint a defender on your behalf. One of us will defend you, using our greater wisdom and experience. Take a moment to think about this, because your life may depend upon it, Kira.
But you are strangers to me. How can you tell the story of my birth? How can you describe my bright eyes, the strength of my hand as I gripped my mother's thumb? Kira stood helplessly, her future at stake. She felt the hostility beside her. Dandara's breath was quick and angry, though her voice had been silenced. She looked at the men seated around the table, trying to assess them as defenders. But she felt from them neither hostility nor much interest, just a sense of expectation as they waited for her decision. As Kira agonized, her hands pushed their way into the deep pockets of her woven shift. She felt the familiar outline of her mother's wooden comb and stroked it for comfort. With her thumb, she felt a small square of decorated woven cloth. She had forgotten the strip of cloth in the recent confusing days. Now she remembered how this one, this design, had come unbidden to her hands as she sat beside her mother in the last days. When she was much younger, the knowledge had come quite unexpectedly to her, and she recalled the look of amazement on her mother's face as she watched Kira choose and pattern the threads one afternoon with a sudden sureness. "I didn't teach you that," her mother said, laughing with delight and astonishment. "I wouldn't know how." Kira hadn't known how either, not really. It had come about almost magically, as if the threads had spoken to her or sung. After that first time, the knowledge had grown. She clutched the cloth, remembering the sense of certainty it had given to her. She felt none of that sureness now. A speech of defense was not within her. She knew she would have to relinquish that role to one of these men, all strangers. She looked at them with frightened eyes and saw one looking calmly, reassuringly back. She sensed his importance to her. She sensed something more, awareness, experience. Kira took a deep breath. The threaded cloth was warm and familiar in her hand. She trembled, but her voice was certain. "Please appoint a defender," she said. The chief guardian nodded.
"Jameson,"
he said firmly, and nodded to the third man on his left. The man with the calm, attentive eyes rose to defend Kira. She waited. Chapter 4. So that was his name, Jameson. It was not familiar to her. There were so many in the village, and the separation of male and female was so great after childhood had ended. Kira watched him stand. He was tall, with longish dark hair, neatly combed and clasped at the back of his neck with a carved wooden ornament that she recognized as the work of the young woodcarver. What was his name? Thomas, that was it. Thomas the Carver, they called him. He was still a boy, no older than Kira herself, but already he'd been singled out for his great gifts, and the carvings that came from his skilled hands were much in demand among the elite of the village. Ordinary people did not ornament themselves. Kira's mother had worn a pendant hanging from a thong around her neck, but she kept it hidden, always, inside the neck of her dress. Her defender picked up the stack of papers on the table before him. Kira had watched him marking these papers meticulously as he listened to the accuser. His hands were large, long-fingered, and sure in their movements. No hesitancy, no uncertainty. She saw that he wore a bracelet of braided leather on his right wrist, and that his arm, bare above the bracelet, was sinewy and muscular. He was not old. His name, Jameson, was still three syllables, and his hair had not grayed. She judged him to be midlife, perhaps the same age that her mother had been. He looked down at the top paper of the stack in his hands. From where she stood, Kira could see the markings that he was examining. How she wished she could read. Then he spoke. "I will address the accusations one by one," he said. Looking at the paper, he repeated the words that Vandara had said, though he did not imitate her rage-laden tone. "The girl should have been taken to the field when she was born and still nameless. It is the way." So that was what he had marked. He had written the words so that he could repeat them. Painful though it was to hear the accusations repeated, Kira realized with awe the value of the repetition. There would be no argument afterward about what had been said. How often among the tykes, fistfights and battles had begun from "you said, I said, he said that you said," and the infinite variations. Jameson set the papers on the table and picked up a heavy volume bound in green leather. Kira noticed that each of the guardians had an identical volume. He opened to a page he had marked during the proceedings. Kira had seen him turning the pages of the volume as Vandara had made her accusatory presentation. "The accuser is correct that it is the way," Jameson said to the guardians. Kira felt stricken by the betrayal. Hadn't he been appointed her defender? He was pointing now to a page, to its densely written text. Kira saw some of the men turn in their green volumes, finding the same passage. Others simply nodded, as if they remembered it so clearly there was no need to reread. She saw Vandara smile slightly. Defeated, Kira felt again the small cloth square in her pocket. Its warmth was gone. Its comfort was gone. "Turning, though," Jameson was saying, "to the third set of amendments..." The guardians all turned pages in their books. Even those whose volumes had remained closed now picked them up and looked for the place. "It is clear that exceptions can be made." "Exceptions can be made," one of the guardians repeated, reading the words, his fingers moving on the page. "So we may set aside the assertion that it is the way," Jameson announced with certainty. "It need not always be the way."
"He is my defender. Perhaps he will find a way to let me live."
"Do you wish to speak?" the defender asked Kira. Touching her scrap of cloth, she shook her head no. He went on, consulting his notes.
"She was imperfect and fatherless as well. She should not have been kept."
The second repetition hurt because it was true. Kira's leg hurt, too. She was not accustomed to standing so still for so long. She tried to shift her weight to ease the pressure on her flawed side.
"These accusations are true,"
Jameson repeated the obvious in his steady voice.
"The girl Kira was imperfect at birth. She had a visible and incurable defect."
The guardians were staring at her. So was Vandara, with contempt. Kira was accustomed to stares. She had been taunted throughout her childhood. With her mother as teacher and guide, she had learned to hold her head high. She did so now, looking her judges in the eyes.
"And fatherless as well," Jameson continued.
In her memory, Kira could hear her mother's voice explaining it to her. She was small then, and wondering why she had never had a father. He did not return from the great hunt. It was before you were born, her mother said gently. He was taken by beasts. She heard Jameson repeat the words of her thoughts as if they had been audible.
Before her birth, her father was taken by beasts, Jameson explained.
The chief guardian looked up from his papers. Turning to the others at the table, he interrupted Jameson.
Her father was Christopher. He was a fine hunter, one of the best. Some of you probably remember him.
Several of the men nodded. Her defender nodded as well.
I was with the hunting party that day, he said. I saw him taken.
You saw my father taken? Kira had never heard the details of the tragedy. She knew only what her mother had told her. But this man had known her father. This man had been there. Was he afraid? Was my father afraid?
It was a strange, unbidden question, and she did not ask it aloud.
But Kira was so afraid herself. She could feel Vandara's hatred as a presence by her side. She felt as if she were being taken by beasts, as if she were about to die. She wondered what the moment had been like for her father.
The Third Amendment applies here as well, Jameson announced. To the accusation she should not have been kept, I reply that according to the Third Amendment, exceptions may be made.
The chief guardian nodded.
Her father was a fine hunter, he said again. The others at the table, taking their lead from him, murmured in agreement. Do you wish to speak? They asked her. Again she shook her head. Again she felt, for the moment, spared. But she has not contributed, Jameson read next. She cannot dig or plant or weed or even tend the domestic beasts the way other girls her age do. She drags that dead leg around like a useless burden. She is slow, he continued, and then Kira saw a hint of a smile as he concluded. And she eats a lot.
The man stood silent for a moment. Then he said,
As defender, I'm going to concede some of these points. It is clear that she cannot dig, or plant, or weed, or tend domestic beasts. I believe, however, that she has found a way to contribute. Am I correct, Kira, that you work at the weaving shed?
Kira nodded, surprised. How did he know? Men paid no attention to the work of women.
Yes, she said, her voice soft from nervousness. I help there. Not with the actual weaving, but I clean up the scraps and help prepare the looms. It is work I can do with my hands and arms. And I'm strong.
She wondered if she should mention her skill with the threads, her hope that perhaps she could use it as a way of making a living. But she couldn't think of a way to say it without sounding vain, so she kept still.
Kira, he said, looking toward her, demonstrate your flaw for the Council of Guardians. Let us see you walk. Go to the door and back.
It was cruel of him, she thought. They all knew about her twisted leg. Why did she have to do this in front of them to submit to their humiliating stares?
For a moment she was tempted to refuse, or at least to argue. But the stakes were too high. This was not a tyke's game, where arguing and fighting were expected. This was what would determine her future, or whether she had a future.
Kira sighed and turned. She leaned on her stick and walked slowly to the door. Biting her lip, she dragged her aching leg step by step and felt Vandara's contemptuous eyes on her back. At the door, Kira turned and came slowly back to her place. Pain started in her foot and seared through her twisted leg. She longed to sit.
She does drag her leg, and she is slow, Jameson pointed out needlessly. I concede those points. Yet her work at the weaving shed is competent. She goes each day for regular hours, and she's never late. The women there value her help. Does she eat a lot? He asked and chuckled. I think not. Look how thin she is. Her weight refutes that accusation. But I suspect she's hungry now, he said.
I am. I suggest we take a break for a meal.
The chief guardian stood.
Do you wish to speak?
He asked Kira for the third time. For the third time, she shook her head no. She felt terribly tired.
You may sit,
he directed Kira and Vandara.
Food